Melanie Olenwick is here, and we are doing our key card 2.0 with Melanie.
Yeah.
Melanie, I call you the OC because you're the original crew. I mean, how many years have you been at Fox 5?
Well, I started in August of 1999. So what is that? 21 years?
Oh my God, 21 years. You truly are the OC.
Oh, I can't believe it. I mean, you know, I say sometimes I think it says something about the station when you have people that are willing to stay that long or want to stay that long. It's definitely changed. I mean, I think the thing that's kept it interesting is my role has changed so many different times. So even though I've been at the same station, I feel like I've done so many different jobs that that always keeps it interesting.
So what's your current title?
Good question.
What is Melanie Olenwick's current title?
I think you would probably say like breaking news reporter, but or, you know, early morning show reporter. But, you know, I do everything.
How many different job titles then do you think you've had in 21 years?
Okay, so I started out as a freelancer, nightside reporter. From there, I went into special projects. Did I do special projects right after that? I think I did. So that's when I was really heavy into doing long format investigations and also consumer pieces.
Okay.
Then after that, I became the money and financial reporter. And that all started like during the 2008 financial crash.
Oh.
And so the director at the time was like, hey, we really need someone to focus on all of these issues and what's going on. So then I did that. And that was like, that was a day shift. Yeah. And then from the money and consumer reporter, I think I went from that. Oh, well, I anchored the Sunday morning show for like 7 years. And I think right from money consumer reporter and then the weekend anchor, I anchored the morning show briefly.
Okay.
And then after that, I've been like the early morning reporter, I want to say probably for 7 years now.
Now, do you consider yourself a financial whiz? Because there's a blog post dedicated to you apparently being a financial whiz and worth $900,000. Do you want to comment?
If only that were true. Where do you find these blog posts? Because occasionally I Google myself and I don't see anything like that. I do see some things I wouldn't want my family to see, but...
Well, there's a bug. People are very fascinated about lots of things that we're going to talk about. They want to know about your personal life. They want to know. And there's a blog where it says Melanie Olenwick, financial reporter whiz and worth $900,000 from her investing. I thought maybe I ought to invest with her when this podcast is done.
Well, let's just say that is not true on either front. The way I approach like financial and consumer reporting is kind of the way I approach anything that's, you know, there's a funny cartoon that I have. It was where it says how reporters start their day. It's one of those non sequitur cartoons. And it shows people standing around with a dart and a dartboard on the back of the room that it says, today I am an expert in, and it has all these different topics, right? So I think the way I approached it when I was first asked, oh, hey, do you think you could handle the money and consumer? I was like, sure. But the way I approach it is I'm going to have the same questions and want to know the same information as people who are on the outside, not on the inside. And so I think that made me good at it, so to speak, because I had to grasp it, understand it, and then be able to explain it to other people.
Right.
And keep kind of digging at it and working it until I knew what was going on well enough to explain it to someone else.
So what do you think has made you so adaptable? You know, you've been there 21 years. That is an eternity now, not just for the new... That's probably the wrong choice of words, but not for the news business, but really for any job. I mean, people sort of average now 5 years, 6 years, but you have taken, and I mean, not to mention the news industry has changed so much. What do you think has been your secret to success and having all these different job titles and succeeding and getting great stories?
Oof. Okay. So I would say the secret to success is just number one, doing a good job, and loving what you do. I mean, there, look, with every job, there are things about it that aren't great. This is a very hard job, but ultimately I still love information. I love writing. I love telling stories. I love being out there and experiencing things and then being able to tell people what I've experienced. And when I think about sometimes about, oh gosh, you know, I'm the old cow in the barn, you know,
no,
you know, maybe it's time for me to leave. I look at other things and nothing else interests me. I mean, this is really what I love doing. So you have to truly have a love for it. And then you have to be willing to put up with some of the crap. And so it's a choice. And you make that choice every day or every contract or whatever when you say, oh, man, I've almost had it. This is really tough. And then, okay, you have a choice to make. You either, and you and I had talked about this before, my mantra has always been, if you're not going to change the situation, you have to change your attitude about the situation. And so you have two choices. You either move on because you want to change the situation, or you stay and you accept what your choice is and make it work for you.
And to your point, it doesn't matter what industry you're in. There's always negative parts, you know? So it's if you're doing what you love, you change your attitude towards things, you know, within reason. But I mean, that's a great mantra.
No. I mean, I would never tell anyone to stay in a bad situation.
Sure.
You know, but I think for me, I've been fortunate to, again, I think the ability to reinvent myself and try different things. And even like with doing the podcast, you know, those were just, I loved doing them. They were super fulfilling for me. And I was fortunate that it seems like within every stage, I've had managers and news directors who saw something in me that maybe I didn't see in myself and gave me opportunities to take risks. And, you know, and that's the other thing too. You have to be willing to take risks because that's how you grow. And, you know, if you fall on your face,
I know.
Right. We've all done that, right?
But isn't the beauty of taking a risk of even if it doesn't work out the way you think, if you have like all the elements you do, right? You know, obviously you have a great openness, a great attitude. You're very good at what you do. So, I mean, you might take a risk and maybe it doesn't work out the way you want, but you always land somewhere on your feet, you know?
You know, I will say I've been lucky. I've been fired more than once.
That's our business. Yeah.
Yes. Not before I came to Fox 5, but I have filed for unemployment.
Yeah.
You know, I'm there. Or like where suddenly the station says, I mean, the very first station I worked at in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I was there for 10 months. I'd signed a 3-year contract. And I got these frantic calls one day from all my coworkers saying, you have to call me. You have to call me. Don't come to work. Don't come to work. I was like, what's going on? Well, it turns out they folded the entire station.
Wow.
And, you know, we were all given our walking papers and I was like, woohoo, great.
That's so the media business too, right? The day they fire you, it's like, all right, get a box. Everything's out. Like, you're fired this minute. There's never like, you know, I mean, warning. All right. Well, I want to, because we're going to talk about your true crime podcast, which you referenced, which is so good. But before that, I kind of thought that you were so adaptable because you were born in California, but you grew up in a military family, right? You all moved quite a bit. How many siblings did you have?
So I have an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay.
And you're right. I think I counted up my moves one time. It's, you know, 15, 20, something like that.
And, okay, you all moved all over the world or just all over the country?
Well, we were international once. So we lived in Bangkok, Thailand for 3 years. And that was really cool. Fun experience. But I think you're absolutely right. I think... that did force me to be adaptable. We lived in California, Colorado, Florida, Alabama, DC, went back and forth to a couple of different places as well as Bangkok. And I think, I've said before, you definitely are adaptable. You're a little bit of a chameleon too. because you kind of assess the situation and you figure out like, okay, well, today I'm going to be this. Or when I lived in Alabama, I had a wicked Southern accent. I mean, who didn't?
I know. No, it's true. You know, when I moved to Ireland for a year, you know what? I did end up adopting a little bit of an Irish. You fit in.
You can't help it. It's, you know, it's just an easier way of speech or whatever. But
Well, tell us a little about your parents. So what branch of the military? Was your dad in the military? Your mom in the military?
Yes. My dad was in the Air Force.
Okay.
My mom was a teacher. Okay. A French teacher. But both were teachers. And so my dad, in addition to he was also a pilot, but he was a historian. And so he taught at the Air Force Academy in the history department. My mom was a French teacher. At the time, none of the other Air Force wives had jobs. And apparently people used to really give my dad a hard time about how come you let your wife work, that kind of thing. Because, I mean, the officers' wives were supposed to be around to entertain and have teas and things like that. But my mom was working.
Wow.
And so as much as she could, she continued to work. There were a couple of times when she wasn't. But even when we moved to Thailand, she got a job teaching English because that's just, it gave her a sense of purpose. And so
did you admire that about your mom growing up, or did you guys kind of resent the fact she wasn't home? Like,
I don't think I realized it until I was older. I realized how much I should appreciate that. When I got older, I certainly did. And I see that as, you know, sort of the women's lib thing. She was the first person in her family to graduate from college, put herself through school. But when you're a teenager, your parents tell you all the time, oh, someday you'll realize it. And I do now.
I do now. Right? Because you're a working mother. And I was going to say, thank God for those women like your mom, because I don't want to stay at home. You know, now that I have my sons, like, I don't want to stay at home. But okay, where did you get your interest, though, in journalism? Was it from your parents? I mean, they were obviously academics and historians, or did it have nothing to do with them?
You know, I think a little bit. And I've said this before, that they taught me early on to ask my own questions. When I wanted to know, hey, what time does the movie start tonight? My dad would say, pick up the phone and call. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to find out that information for you. You find it for yourself.
Yeah.
And I think I wasn't, and never be afraid to ask questions. And I ask a lot of questions. And I think that is sort of the hallmark of the reporter. It can make me a little annoying sometimes to people, but, I even had a teacher in school one time. This was she an English teacher or a history teacher? She was an English teacher. She told me to stop asking so many questions. I mean,
really?
Who tells a student not to ask so many questions? But I did.
So, you know, tell me this, like when you went to college, mm-hmm. You decide at what point, I think I'm interested in becoming a reporter. Or was that the goal? Or did you see somebody on TV and you were like, you know what? I want to be on the television. Was it the television? Was it the reporting? Was it the storytelling? Or was it just like, oh, you know what? I need like some sort of career path. Oh, this looks kind of fun. I'll be the traffic reporter.
Well, you know, it's a little of both, actually, because I remember like writing my own little neighborhood newspaper when I was a kid. You know,
Just
on like lined paper, drawing little pictures and things. And that must have been like, gosh, was that like 19? Oh, I'm not going to say when, but I think I was probably like 10 years old or 11 years old. And then the TV thing, you know, I remember watching PM Magazine.
Okay.
Remember that show PM Magazine?
No, but I lived in like rural Maine. I don't know. We had like rabbit ears.
Right,
I got
right.
like two stations. So
some people who got PBS would probably do PM Magazine, and that and I saw that and I was like, oh, I could do that. I like to write. I like to talk. I definitely like to talk. I remember when my dad used to drive us home at night from our music lessons. He would always have NPR on, so we were always listening to news and information and in that respect. So I was kind of tuned into that kind of stuff to begin with. And then seeing this PM Magazine that I used to watch. And so when I went to college, I went with the goal that that's what I wanted to do, I kind of fell off it for a little while. I don't think I came out of school with the confidence to go for it right away. So I took a job with a video production company, and then I took a job at Channel 9 here in DC.
Oh, wow.
But as a secretary.
Really?
Yes.
You're checking yes. in all the reporters and the guests.
Right.
Building up your baby journalism courage.
Yeah, I did. So I was the newsroom secretary, and I did that for several years. But then in my spare time, I would like go to reporters and say, "Hey, can I log a tape for you? Can I write something for you? What else can I do?"
Yeah.
And I always tell people, if you want to get in this business, you know, you're never too important for anything that needs to be done. Just do whatever you have to do. Just get in there. Just experience it. Be helpful. Be indispensable.
Totally. It's such a business that if you're there, I think that's so true. If you're there and you have the chutzpah and the intelligence, it will happen. It will happen. You know, you have to put yourself in that position. Now, where did you go to college? Here in D.C.?
No, I started at University of Florida. I went there for 2 years, right. And then I transferred to James Madison because my parents gave up their Florida residency and became Virginia residents. So I came back to Virginia.
So tell everybody, I love the story of how you really got your job at Fox 5, because you actually competed against a very well-known national television host.
And yes.
Did you think that you were going to, Amy Robach, who a lot of people know, you know, yep. she's on ABC mm-hmm. National News.
Yeah.
Now she does like Dateline, and I think she still does, you know, Good Morning America. Anyway, so you and Amy were up for the helicopter traffic reporter job, right?
That is correct. That is correct. So going into it, my agent said, who happened to be Amy's agent, I think, conflict of interest, who knows? But I still love him. He said to me, "Oh, well, just so you know, this is a beauty contest."
I love it.
Well, I mean, after I found out who got the job, I was like, well, I didn't even have a shot. I mean, what was that all about?
Former what, Miss USA or Miss Georgia? I mean,
Miss
you know.
Georgia, I think. I was like, well, okay, clearly I'm not going to get that job. But it was an audition. And in addition to going up in the helicopter to see how you did and how you looked in the helicopter, you also had to do a writing test and do an interview, that sort of thing. And I made sure that we had to go on breaking news when I was in the helicopter. So I pretended like I was reporting and I did the breaking news. And then when we got back late, I was in the cab on the way back to the station. I'm like, let me finish up my writing test. So I made sure I didn't just let that go. When I came in, I turned it back into the news director. I said, here, I finished this on the way back. And I think that impressed her. So she saw something in me and she said, you know what? I don't think you are the one for the chopper job, but
we have a Miss Georgia here that we're going to put.
Right. But I would like you to come on as a reporter. I think you'd be a really good reporter for us. And the rest is history.
So speaking of looks, how have you dealt with that? Or has that never bothered you? I mean, we are in this industry. Yeah, tell me how you've gotten your confidence, or have you gone home at night, or have you tried to be thinner or more attractive? You know, because we do, after a while, it gets to you, right?
It does, sure. I mean, when I was trying to get that first job I had a news director say to me, "Oh, what do I need with another blonde?"
I was wow.
like, hair color, you know, it can change. Just tell me what you want it to be. Yeah, I mean, I think in the early years struggled with that. I had been told at times, "Oh, well, you're too all American. You need to be more glamorous." But then when I tried the glamour thing, it didn't feel like me. You know, I could probably use some hair extensions, but I don't, because I'm not in the studio every day. The job that I do out in the field requires, you know, the wind is blowing, the rain is coming down. You know, I don't want to mess with that stuff. I've got too many other things to deal with. I mean, I certainly, everybody worries about their weight. I've tried, but you know, false eyelashes. I wear them sometimes. Sometimes I don't, because again, I'm like worried they're gonna fall off when I'm in the middle of a lie report.
What's your take though? Don't you think in the end, really good journalism and storytelling beats out looks? Now, you're a very attractive person. Okay. But I mean, I think we've seen over the years, whether it's our station, other stations, right? Beautiful women kind of come and go, but ultimately you can be super hot. But if you can't do the job after a while, it doesn't work, right? Or do you
I think you're right, but I think there's still, I think things have gotten a lot better. Mm. And again, I'm still here. So I don't think aging has hurt me at all. And that is a big concern that I think a lot of people in the business have. It's different for men than it is for women.
Yeah.
You know? And I think in anything, you know, men are allowed to age gracefully and women aren't supposed to age. And I think a lot of that comes with just a little more self-confidence and being comfortable with who you are and knowing that you're good at your job.
Yes.
And not trying to measure up to anybody else anymore. It doesn't mean you don't still try.
Sure.
But you don't compare yourself to other people. And I know you've been through your struggles too, and you've been very open with it. And I think it's been very helpful to people to know that they're not alone in that.
Well, you said it, you have to be comfortable in your own skin, right? And I've tried dieting, and I was always overweight as like a young person and as a kid. And, you know, after a while you just, it's like, I can't do a starvation diet. Like, this is who I am. If you want to hire me for who I am, then I'm the person for you. But if not, you know, that's not it. And, you know, I want to talk about your amazing true crime reporting. But, I mean, I've tried being a true crime podcaster. I thought I was going to be this fabulous investigative reporter like you. I got in and I was depressed. I'm too much of a comedian and I say inappropriate things. I thought, I can't report true crime. So tell me, okay, we started this sort of, I'm trying to think of what it became branded as. What's our crime podcast? See, I should know. It started as the Mansion Murder podcast, but then it became Missing Pieces.
Oh, it became Missing Pieces to kind of be the umbrella to encompass all the other different stories that we tell under that.
Okay, so then you do a Missing Pieces series on the young man that was out doing a film shoot out west. He goes missing from the set, never to be seen again, still to this day, right? They don't know
Correct.
What happened
That's
to him.
Right.
And so tell me about that experience. Now, obviously, you had a lot of experience in journalism and good and investigative journalism. I mean, I was like a lost, it was not good. But did you enjoy doing, because true crime is so hot, did you enjoy doing it, or do you find that it's weird that people are so into crime?
So I do recognize that the genre can be somewhat exploitive. And I'm very careful with the stories that I choose, because I am uncomfortable sometimes with people's kind of weird fascination with true crime. But when I choose a story, it has to have certain elements. And
okay, what? You've got to tell us, because you are a really great journalist. So what are those?
Well, I need to make sure that I can develop the story, that I have the right people to talk to. You know, for example, the one I did before the search for Terrence Woods was Allison Thresher, the search for Allison Thresher, who's been missing forever. And the key was being able to talk to her kids. Mm. So, you know, and those were voices that had never been heard before. And the investigators being willing to talk with us. So you're hearing it from the family. You're hearing from the investigators. You are able to talk to people who are around and there, because you need to be able to hear from all sides, because it's really important not to go into these things with an idea of how it's going to turn out. Because otherwise you tend to maybe choose sound bites that lead people in one direction, or even you get led in a direction. And if you're not opening your mind to what could be another explanation for this, what could be another way to tell the story, who else haven't I talked to, then I think you can tend to skew it in a way that perhaps isn't, I don't want to say the truth, but because
it's not bias, right? I mean, I think that's what is so compelling. And I think the general public doesn't realize or give you guys enough credit, like how difficult it is to remain not biased. I mean, has there been a story in your career where you really, it got into your head where you really wanted an outcome or you really wanted to lead the viewer? Because that, I mean, look, when I was a true crime reporter for a brief time, I thought, oh, I'm going to break this case wide open. There's going to be multiple mm-hmm. people involved. It's like, you don't know that, you know, I mean, right. But I'd gotten too into the outcome.
Right. Well, I mean, I think both with both of the ones I did, I really hoped that I would find an outcome. And the other thing, too, is you can't be afraid to disappoint the family.
Ah.
And that's a hard thing because they trust you. They come to you, or whoever it is, whether it's family or the person that has the story to tell, they come to you because they trust you to see things their way. And I won't make any promises that it's ultimately it's going to turn out that way. I mean, I know with the situation with Terrence Woods, it's still an open investigation. It's hard for the family to accept that maybe something sinister didn't happen. We just don't know. It has all the elements of maybe something sinister did. But when you start going down the road and you talk to the sheriffs and you talk to, it took a long time and I finally was able to locate people who were actually there, who were there on the search, who had talked to Terrence that morning, who told us about their point of view on it. And there's no proof that anything sinister happened. And it's hard to leave it that way. And you also think, oh, you know, maybe somebody's going to find him, just like with, and so far we haven't, just like with Allison Thresher. I mean, the access that her kids gave me, Hannah and Sam, was incredible. And I learned things about what happened to her that night that we had never known before. And we knew who the prime suspect was. That all got revealed during the podcast. It was happening as I was working on it. And then the main suspect, Fernando Astoriaga, committed suicide. And so we thought, you know, and the police thought, the investigators thought he's going to lead them to her body, but he didn't. He committed suicide in prison. And so everyone's kind of left with, we know maybe where they're going to search or perhaps where it is, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And so we didn't get the end result we wanted, but I think, I hope that there was a catharsis there for Hannah Thresher and Sam Thresher. And ultimately, I think that's what sticks with me and why I do it is that when I pick a story, it's because I feel an obligation to the victim to tell their story, to get it out there, but to be honest and fair with it as well.
That's amazing. I mean, and by the way, people can listen to that Missing Pieces, the Allison Thresher story. And she went, just to give people a little context that may not be familiar with our true crime podcast. So Allison Thresher went missing how many years ago? And I'm assuming from the DC area?
Right. So I want to say was it almost 27 years ago now? No, it couldn't have been 27 because I was on, had to have been like 20 years ago because I was on the story when she disappeared.
Wow.
So her, she lived in Bethesda, an apartment, and people had heard like someone crying, and then she didn't show up for work the next day. She was supposed to start a new job at the Washington Post. And when she didn't show up for work, people got suspicious and they made some phone calls. Police went to the house, she was gone. We found out later that there was blood stains on her bed sheets. There was some burn marks in her carpet, things that we didn't know that led, we didn't know then. People kept saying, well, maybe she disappeared or she'd had a fight with a boyfriend or maybe she took off. And we didn't really know all those other pieces about that they concluded that she was the victim of a homicide. And then it was just a question of who was responsible. And was it just Fernando who was responsible, or did he have help?
So tell me the story that you're either the biggest story you ever broke, or the story that you're proudest of, or the story that, yeah.
That's tough. You know, I have to say there, when I'm able to do stories that make a difference, we did an investigation on elevator. It sounds ridiculous, right? Elevator inspections, right? Turns out that the elevator inspectors in DC weren't really inspecting them. And you think, oh, what's the big deal on that? Well, we talked to people who had been killed in elevators. And by talking to these people, and again, sharing their pain and sharing their stories, one little boy, his family lived up in near Baltimore. And it was just horrible, horrible to hear what his parents had to witness. And, but real change came from that, because we went to the DCRA, we uncovered what was happening, and that was a real, that changed. So anytime you do a story where it can affect change, I think is,
yeah. I mean, isn't that the power of journalism and why you do it and the amazing things that come from it? I mean, you know, yeah, that's the amazing thing about the press. I know in the past couple of years, it's media's gotten a bad rap, and you know, some of it deserves, some of it not. But the truth is like, you know, what you do does have a huge, like, yeah, people take notice.
Right, and a funny story, like the first time I really felt the impact of that, of the power of television, was when I was working at Channel 9, newsroom assistant. We were doing the whole little Toys for Tots special.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why don't we do this? Let's go where they do the letters to Santa, and let's grab a bunch of letters from the post office, these letters for Santa, and let's read them on the air. So they did that, and they were reading on the air. This little girl, you know, what kids wanted, and this little girl wanted a bike. And I tell you what, like, people were showing up and calling and saying, I'm going to buy that bike.
Amazing.
And it really just, it was the most amazing thing. And I was like, look, you ask and people respond, you touch their hearts and they respond. So I think that really stuck with me, that if you give people something they can act on in a positive way, people ultimately want to participate. And I think they want to do good.
Oh, I agree. 100%. Right. We live in like just the most generous world. I mean, people show up, you know, I mean, you see that when you do these great stories in positive ways, lots of times. All right. Well, let's shift gears and talk about your personal life, which you don't really like to talk about. Why have you decided, you know, as someone who puts everything, you know, basically the time I ate breakfast out, why have you chosen to be so private?
You know, it's just, maybe I'm not comfortable talking about myself that much. Maybe I think my old school journalism training is the story is about other people. It's not about you.
Ah, okay.
And so I think that's part of it. And part of it is I just try to keep a small circle. I try to very much separate work and home.
Okay.
It's harder these days, certainly with the pressures of social media and those sorts of things. But you know, even like early on, my husband and I decided that we would not put our kids on social media. I do occasionally here and there, and we've done it here and there. And look, I don't have a problem with anybody who does, but it's just a choice that we made. And now that they're older, I ask their permission. Hey, is this okay?
Yeah.
Do you mind? Because social media now stays with you forever. So we just kind of decided that, and I try to keep my work life and my home life separate.
Now you are well, you are married. You have two children. And how many years have you and your husband been married?
Oh my gosh, that's funny. I forget sometimes. I would say almost 20. Almost 20.
Damn, that's good, girl. How have you kept that marriage right? together? That's that is big, especially like you're a public figure.
Almost 20 people. Well, yeah, and I think that's part of it, you know, that we don't mix that. And maybe part of it is we don't really see each other very often. He's very busy. I'm very busy. We kind of laugh like, okay, I'll see you on the weekend. And some of that is also me working the early morning shift. You know, I get up at 1:30 in the morning.
Oh,
I'm tiptoeing around the house. I leave the house, you know, super early. I'm on the air at 4 a.m. I get home and, you know, right now this is great. Nobody's here. they're finally gone for like 18 months, right? I would come home from work. And my kids were here doing school and my husband was in the office. Now they're not here, which is really great. but so we do joke around that we think sometimes just not being on top of each other, seeing each other all the time kind of keeps things better.
And I know you are private, but I had read that he owns a flooring company.
No, that is not correct.
Oh, Melanie, like maybe she'll give us a tour of her great floors in her house. Like I was like, this woman must have like granite floors everywhere if they own a flooring company. But that's not true.
No flooring company. My husband is also in the media business. And I think some of that is also why we try to keep things private. And I will say also, you know, there's a little bit, there's also that safety concern for me. You know,
yeah.
I think everybody does. And so you want to be careful with how much you put out there because I know how much you can find out about somebody by searching their social media. Trust me. How do you think I find some of these people? Because
it's all there. I know.
People are not careful with what they post. And you can find out a lot of information about someone. So that's part of the reason why we're somewhat careful with that. But I think I told you, even when we first started dating, it was somewhat private.
Yes. I don't know. You know, you guys met basically at work, right? You're kind of both working in media. You met at work, but you never even told anyone at work, right? That you were even.
No, we did not. No. So he worked in the sports office and I worked in the newsroom. I mean, Sarah, it was hilarious. We would do things like because some of the guys in the sports office thought they knew, but we would throw them off the trail because like they would get up and they would look. And they'd be like, I almost said his name. They would say, well, he's on the phone and Melanie's on the phone. We're looking across the newsroom. But then what we would do is one of us would hang up and leave and the other one would stay on the phone.
You were pulling out all this stuff. And were you two like even engaged and no one knew? Like you guys?
Yes, that is true.
Uh-huh. And you were like planning a wedding. No one even knew. Did you even invite anyone from the station or you just came back one week and were like, hey guys.
We invited a couple of close friends. So eventually, after we were dating for a while and we realized, okay, we're not going to break up with each other, then just our close personal friends, we let know. We were like, don't tell anybody. It's just kind of, you know, it's that kind of thing. Like I didn't want people asking me about my personal life. I just didn't want that to be fodder for the newsroom.
Yeah.
I don't think it's not great policy to date somebody you work with, but in our business, like in a lot of businesses,
in
hospitals, in public safety and in schools, you know, that's where you meet people, right? You meet people at work.
You're getting up at 1:30 in the morning, girl. You're not going out dating. I mean, who wants to meet you for a date at noontime? I mean, nobody.
Right. Well, thank goodness I'm married. You know, back then we were working nightside. And so that was a really great time. It was a really great time. People would, you know, we worked hard, we played hard, we partied hard, you know.
Yeah.
It was a really good time. We had a good group of people in that nightside group. But it was sort of like I just felt like I didn't want people in my personal business. And right, even when we got married, I didn't want people asking me about, what are you gonna wear? What's your dress?
That's not your style. I mean, to your point, like you guys, it's weird because I do think for some reason reporters like now, like everybody wants to know your personal life. But I mean, your job is not to come on and reveal what you're wearing. I mean, but yet it's kind of morphed into that for some people.
Yes. Well, the job has changed. And so, you know, I'm fortunate that, you know, I've said this before, even with other, just my changing roles and things, I've been fortunate that I've had managers and news directors that kind of let me be me.
Yeah.
And I think that helps because I can do my own thing. I can play the game, and I do to a certain extent, but I don't think you have to push everybody into the same mold. That's what having a group of people is all about. That's diversity, right? There's diversity can take all different shapes and sizes and forms. It, you know, it's not just diversity of look. It can be diversity of thought. It can be diversity of style, of delivery, of, you know, those sorts of things. So I'm glad that they're not, when someone says, well, that's just not really my thing, that it's not a well do this or get out.
So how have you been a good mom and a great reporter? I mean, you're an Emmy winning, you're an Emmy winning journalist. I mean, you know, you work, you get up at 1:30 in the morning, you've worked every shift under the sun. You have two children that are now teenagers. I mean, how did you do it? And like, did you feel unbelievable guilt or not really? I mean, so far I feel no guilt, like sending my kid to daycare. I'm like, great. You know, but no, sure it gets harder, you know?
Well, I mean, to be honest, we did have a nanny for a while, but I had no other choice.
Yeah.
You know, I really didn't. I mean, it was really hard. I mean, we were taking our kids to my husband's cousin's house, which is great. He's got a huge family in this area. So we definitely had a lot of support with that. My parents were helpful on if we had to travel or weekends or that sort of thing. And of course, my husband's parents also very helpful too. A little more difficult as the kids are teenagers now. It's not like they want to go to the grandparents' house for the weekend, and it's certainly not going to trust them here by themselves. But again, it's all about things change. But you know, I think I just keep going. I don't really know. I don't know how to explain it any other way. But sometimes we talk about being on the hamster wheel, you know, or just keep swimming with Dory or whatever. But it's, I don't know. You embrace each stage.
Yeah.
You try to. I also think that getting married a little later in life helped, because I never felt like I was missing out on anything. I spent a long time being single and having fun and working really hard. And I do think that being a parent does change a little bit. I don't know if dads feel the same way. I'd be curious, but I think once you have children, you have a lot more to lose. And so it does change your approach to work a little bit, especially this job where you can end up on dangerous assignments. So, you know, I've traveled to war zones. I've had to wear body armor and flak jackets. I was in a plane once that where there was a bird strike on a C-130, and we had to make an emergency landing. I've done hurricanes, protests, you know,
When is the time you felt the most in danger? Like, oh my God, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter. I'm like, this could maybe not be good.
So the interesting thing is, the times I feel most in danger are the early mornings when it's just me and a photographer and we're trying to set up somewhere, and it's 3 a.m. There's nothing good is happening at 3 a.m. in a lot of places. And so it's more I feel the most in danger when there's that stranger danger. It's someone that comes up that is acting erratically. You have to treat it as a serious situation, because you can't assume that someone's not going to try to hurt you or rob you or those kind of things. I think that's the scariest, not the big situations, not the giant, not the big protests,
not the war zone. It's basically every day when you go to work. Okay. Damn, that's true though. You're very vulnerable out there. And unfortunately, because the media has been under attack in the past couple of years, you know, I think people a little bit are emboldened to come up to you all or feel like you're doing something evil or what, you know, who knows what goes through people's minds. Right. So sometimes that's on your mind.
Yeah, it's on my mind. It's on my mind every day. But I shouldn't say every day, but there are some situations where you just get that spidey sense.
Yeah.
And you think, really, I shouldn't be here. This isn't good. This isn't good at all.
And what do you guys do? Pack up? Like, I'd be like, all right, sorry, I'm doing this in the van.
sometimes we do. And we do have the support of our management that if things don't feel right, then no live shot is worth your life. Our news director has said that over and over again, and I believe them. And so we do have the support to do that. But, you know, things sometimes happen quickly.
Yeah.
So you're always trying to be aware and look around you and assess the situation.
What do you think that you want people to know about your job that people don't know? Because people make a lot of assumptions about reporters and media now. What do you think people don't really get?
I am so glad that you asked me that, because I think people don't realize how much work we do and how much we care. I think sometimes people make assumptions that we have, an agenda, or that advertisers tell us what to say or what to do, or that we don't have conversations about ethical dilemmas. So we get just kind of cast into this big lump, the media. I had to tell people before, I'm not the media, I'm Melanie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm responsible for me, and I report my way. And you know, I would hope that by doing that other people perhaps will act the same way. But I mean, just little tiny things like word choice, right? If I said Sarah left the room, that's one thing. But if I said Sarah fled the room, or Sarah ran out of the room.
Stormed out, yeah.
Stormed out. I mean, it's the same action, but it means something very different. And I think for me as a reporter, and the things that people don't realize is I think about those things. I think about word choice. I think about, you know, I'll call back to the station. I'll say, hey, wait a second. I'm not sure we should be saying something this way, because do we really know that for sure? Or what are we trying to do here? Or conversations about, should we be showing this video or not showing this video? What we have a lot of ethical conversations about what we do and how we do it. And I think people don't know that. And I would like to be more open and transparent about those things, because I think that helps build trust. And we really do need to do a better job of telling our own story.
Yeah.
So that people begin to trust us again. That is probably one of the most hurtful things to me, is when people just kind of lump me in and they don't have any idea how hard I work or the thought process that I go through before I say something on air.
Oh my God, totally. I wish people knew that about the integrity of the Fox 5 newsroom. Because all of you all, you know, but you come to mind, Bob Barnard, Fitz, you know, I mean, really there's, this is not a flippant, oh, today I'm just going to go out and find a story. I mean, there's so much that goes into it, you guys, the work that you do. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to do some rapid fire fun questions.
Oh, no.
What's your favorite music group? I think I read, too, that you love concerts, you love music. I mean, who doesn't, right? But what's your favorite music group?
Okay, so music group is kind of hard because I listen to a lot of music, but I would say the things that are in constant rotation for me are probably Ben Folds and Kenny Chesney.
Oh, you're a Kenny Chesney fan. I love it.
I do. I love Kenny Chesney. It puts me in a good mood. It's just a vibe.
Have you seen him in concert?
Yes, I have. I brought my kids to the concert where Eric Church opened up for him at FedEx Field. And the one thing my kids remember is Eric Church with the two bottles of beer, like, you know, because he was singing Drink in My Hand. And I was like, okay, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. But it was good. It was good.
Oh, my God. He's amazing. I read you love to travel. Favorite place that you've been?
Okay. I have to say two.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I can't put it down to one. One would be Northern England. And the other would be the south of France.
Oh, oh my gosh.
So you've been to Scotland. So you've been to Scotland.
Amazing. Yes.
And so we went to, my last name here in America is Alnwick, but in England it's Unick. And there's an Unick Castle in Northumberland. It's owned by the Duke of Northumberland. It's where they filmed some of the Harry Potter movies.
Okay.
It's where they did some Downton Abbey. And my family did a big trip there a couple years ago before my mom passed away. And it was our last really big vacation together. And so we have such good memories and we're so glad that we did that. We rented this big manor house, and there was this gate where you could go down to little blue house by the little sea, little, like, we called it the little blue house by the sea because they had a little separate beach cottage down the hill from the manor.
Yep.
And it was, the English countryside is amazing and beautiful, and which people don't realize. My kids got to swim in the North Sea.
Oh my God.
It was very cool. Yeah, we drove up to St. Andrews, and they got to see, you know, we took that whole thing. So Northern England was great. And then the South of France is where my husband's grandfather is from. So we took the kids there so that they could see. And again, like, I think it's important. I think travel is super important, especially for kids.
Yes.
Take them. Don't be afraid. Take your kids. They're so adaptable. They're such good little travelers. And they need to see that the world is so much bigger than the bubble that we live in here in the DC area.
Preach.
And, yes. And the South of France was great because they had to hear and learn a different language.
Yeah.
And also to understand where their family history and where family is from. So that was a little town called Argelès was the beach we went to, and Perpignan was down where my husband's grandfather had lived, and he had been there many times when he was little. So it was nice to be able to do that. And we always do like the capital city, and then where the real people live.
Yes, yes.
So my next trip is Sicily. That was supposed to be during the pandemic, but we haven't gotten there yet. And now my kids' passports have expired, and that's a hassle. So who knows?
Doing all that. Okay, Melanie, do you have a favorite drink? You always are so well behaved at work. I mean, I don't even have any good, I don't have any good bar stories of you. I mean, you know, I mean, so
oh,
do
well,
we.
You're asking, girl, you're asking the wrong people, Sarah, but I'm not going to tell you who to ask.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was going to say, no good rumors about you, girl. But if we catch you having a drink, what are you drinking? Are you a margarita girl? Are you a wine girl? Are you no drinks?
Well, I do like wine, but generally I start with something called an Aperol Spritzer.
Yes, very popular right now. Yes.
And I love it. It's just kind of, it's got its kick to it more than you'd think, but it's just kind of one of those things where like, oh, I'm going to have the Aperol first. I don't know. Maybe it sounds cool. It tastes good. It's fun. So I like that first, and then I'll go on to the wine. And I have been known to, you know, I like my old fashions also. I like a good old fashioned with one of those giant ice cubes in it. Because you can just kind of, it just feels good going down. It's just, especially in the wintertime.
Okay. Is there a hobby that you have that we don't know about?
I like calligraphy. I did a lot when I was younger, and painting, drawing. I minored in art in college. So, but calligraphy was something I always loved. Sort of it's like an old, old art. And, there's something about it. And I think it's neat because not only I love words, it's also art with words.
Oh my God. You're like the queen of patience because good journalism, calligraphy. Oh my God. These are very tight.
Yeah. And I dabble in guitar too, but as I say, only well enough to entertain myself, not anybody else.
Okay, last question. Is there any job in the media business that you still want to have? I mean, are you looking to become the general manager of Fox 5? Bye, Patrick.
Bye, Patrick. No.
Bye, Patrick.
You know, I don't know. I feel like I've done everything that there is to do, but there's always more out there. I love long format. I love investigations. Mm. I love really deep writing. And I hope that, you know, sometimes you have to make choices. And so while I'm trying to get my kids through school and into college and those sorts of things, I'm good with where I am right now. It works for me. It works for my family. My bosses, you know, hopefully are happy. No?
I think all is well. I think all is well.
With what I do, but I think I still have a lot to give. And that's kind of a cool thing to realize. It's cool to realize there really doesn't have to be a finish line. You don't have to say, okay, well, now I'm done. I feel like I can really turn it on. I've got a lot of stories in here, things I kind of have sketched down and things I'd like to do. And I think that's really where I'd like to take it someday. I don't know about management. I like to deal with my own problems, not everybody else's.
Yeah, no thanks. I always tell people too, I'm not afraid of aging anymore in media because young people aren't watching TV. They need us.
That's true.
It's ain't no women under 35 watching television. So they need us, girl. We have job security now. Joke's on them.
Yeah. Do you do TikTok?
I do.
Oh, I haven't done it yet.
Look, you could start your own storytelling on TikTok. You would have a million followers and that could be your whole new career. Believe me, people are dying for great storytelling on TikTok. That's the whole premise.
But it's not storytelling, is it? Isn't it just
there's a whole division for people that are your kids' age that love just the dancing, the pranks, that kind of thing. But there's a whole nother, people are leaving Facebook and Instagram in droves and TikTok is like not slowing down. And some of the biggest people I follow are just they just tell stories. Stories of their childhood, their life. Oh my God, if you did true crime, you'd have 18 million followers and I'd be sitting there going, what am I doing wrong with my life? I need to get back into it.
Yeah, but true crime has to be, you know, again, it's not quick.
No, it's not. And good true crime journalism takes a lot of time, a lot of investigating,
Someday you'll show me what to do on TikTok.
Anytime. I'm telling you, there's a whole thing there. Yeah, it's for real. Melanie, this has been such a treat. Thank you for sharing so much, I think, of your personal life and kind of like your mantra and what has worked in your career. I mean, I love it. You've never done this before. So this is really cool. Where can people, before you launch your TikTok, where do people find you and follow you?
Well, Fox5Melanie is my handle on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. So that's pretty much it.
Love it, Melanie. Thank you for being on.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it, Sarah. Let's do it again sometime.
We will. Amazing.